Hi, it's April. Today's podcast is possible because of Michigan Radio, a public radio station. If you know about podcasts, you know that many are powered by advertising revenue. That is not how we do things. We're raising money for our work this week, and we need your help so that we can continue to bring you these Michigan stories. If you can help support us, go to michiganradio.org to donate. You'll find that link in today's show notes. In honor of this fundraising week, we're bringing you some of our favorite Stateside Pod episodes from the past year. Today, we're going to listen again to Jonah Mixon Webster talking about stereotype. Flint-born poet Jonah Mixon Webster's new collection, Stereotype, got a second life this summer.
When I walk towards you, I am an awkward thing. Up top, too thick, too lanky.
It originally came out in 2019, published by Asada Press. This summer, it saw a reprint published by a much larger imprint, Knopf. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you've never read his poetry before, you're in for a totally immersive experience. Jonah Mixon Webster's writing tackles rough experiences without pulling punches, using dynamic and imaginative language forms of his own device. Since we first spoke, he's started a postdoctoral fellowship in African American Studies at Columbia University in New York. Jonah Mixon Webster, welcome to Stateside.
Oh my God, thank you so much, April.
It's a pleasure. Hey, the very first poem in the collection is called Invocation of the Sacrosanct. And it's, I just love the way you put this together. It describes a ritual, naming some stereotypic things that some people associate with Black men, articles of clothing, things that people might wear.
Find six stereotypical tokens of Blackness for the body, an article for each: head, neck, wrists, ankles, feet. For mine, I chose a 5950 bang to the back, a Jesus piece, a Pelly Pelly with a fur collar, a faux platinum watch with a bracelet, and a pair of Tims. Now, accompany the tokens with two intoxicants, one to drink, one to inhale. For mine, I chose a 50 Remy Martin.
And it calls upon phrases that, you know, that are sort of part of a stereotypical archetype. Certain movements and behaviors. It's almost like you're describing a performance art piece or some kind of social practice.
Mm-hmm.
In asking us to partake in the ritual, it feels like you're inviting us into the things that the ways in which people sometimes expect Black men to be performative, especially
yes.
white people.
Yes.
And then it wraps up with this line.
Stop. Now, write a poem that will raise you from the dead.
This feels like a ritual you've performed a few times.
Is that obvious?
Yes. I don't know.
Yes, it is. Actually, like that entire ritual was taken through just my own kind of, you know, identity formation, you know, and the ways in which I was performing these same stereotypes that I thought I should, you know, adopt, or I should, you know, be presenting because I'm a Black man, right? And in a lot of ways, they were the performances, these were the rituals that kept me alive. It wasn't the poems, mostly. And so trying to subvert or turn, you know, kind of my identity and the way I perform it around, right, and kind of get towards the thing that's going to make me more of my authentic self, you know, it's kind of having to bump up against this futility, right? Like, can a poem do that, actually? Can a poem keep you out of the grave?
There's another poem a little bit later in the collection that I just really loved. It's called The Ghost of Richard Pryor Made Me Do It. Let's listen to a clip.
Like any night, a white man sees me, seeing him, seeing me. I am again dead awake to the modes of awareness. And it was as if him seeing me meant seeing me naked, Black, obviously Black, ostensibly Black, meant seeing me. And you know what I mean already. I mean, you know, I was probably wearing something real Black, like something blacker than Black, something like a Black hoodie with a Black V-neck under it, a Black snapback, Black jeans, and Black shoes. And seeing me in all of this meant he knew I was Black. And I mean, real Black, naked Black, obviously Black, ostensibly Black, and within proximity Black still says, hey, give me a cigarette, to his white friend with me in earshot chose to say, yeah.
This poem describes making eye contact with a white guy. Mm-hmm. And first of all, feeling hyper aware of just being seen. Mm-hmm. And then going on to overhear the white guy use the N-word to a friend in a way that black people sometimes use in a conversational way with each other.
Exactly.
And you can tell reading the poem, first of all, just how wildly inappropriate that action is, and how the word is being made into a weapon with the white guy daring you, almost daring you to call him out for using it.
Yeah. Daring me to do even more. Yeah, that experience was so surreal. You know, of course, I've grown up hearing non-black people use the N-word to various effects and for various reasons, various purposes. But this instance, I was just so caught off guard. And like you mentioned, so starkly aware of the position I was in. And I think that's when really it kind of made me realize what that word makes you feel as a black person when it's coming out of the mouth of someone who's non-black. And we get to the point like as if saying it meant seeing me naked. Right. That and that is the feeling. That's when the times, you know, in my actual real adult life, I had to explore, you know, what's the actual power of this word? You know, mm-hmm. I thank you for bringing that up. A lot of people don't talk about because, you know, I use the N-word a lot throughout the book, you know, to recontextualize and decontextualize, you know, some of its meaning. But I call it a conjure word. Right. You conjure mm-hmm. something up. When you use it, the real life, what actually happened was after he says like, come on, what you going to do? And, you know, N-word, you know, and then so I kind of cocked my fist back and he cowers and we all laugh. Everybody in the bar laughed. And then he kept going again. And he kept calling me the N-word over and over and over again. And that's when, you know, so like this. Merge or this kind of, you know, mixture of the comedy, the hilarity that was there, but that anger that was there, that was a real tense contrast for me. And so, and literally going from laughing at, you know, at him kind of cowering at a faint punch, you know, to then, you know, egging me on even more. And then having to literally choke him. And I mean, what really happened, I asked him, who's the real N now? Right. Even in displays of humor and displays of anger, you know, that stereotype, that, you know, that image of the stereotype, the angry black man or the black buffoon. Right. Are the two things that I'm constantly, you know, kind of toggling between.
Yeah. The second part of the collection actually begins with a knockout quote by the writer Sadia Hartman. It reads, "We need to consider why the sight of suffering so readily lends itself to inviting identification. Why is pain the conduit of identification?" It feels like that gets to a lot of the stuff that you're saying in the poems about, you know, wanting to have this life outside of trauma, outside of rage, mm-hmm. outside of violence that one does not choose. But also the need to talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some kind of futility that I think, you know, black people are constantly struggling with, right? And it's literally because of these stereotype formations of identity. And it's the stereotypes that have been levied against black people throughout history. The infantilizing, you know, you're too underdeveloped. You haven't, you know, matured enough. Right. To understand. But there are real violences. Right. There are real traumas. And they do really inform our identities. And so it's like, no matter as much as we might want to slip outside of that or go beyond it, even, we still have to contend with it. Even though these are rhetorical questions, I think, right, especially in the context of you know, what Sadia Hartman might also say as, you know, black people having to live the afterlife of slavery. I think it's it's just to make us ponder, right, what is it also about human nature, right, that asks us to identify pain or to identify with pain or what has it, how have we been socialized to identify ourselves by the pain we go through? And those are questions that Black people have to always, you know, answer and presume, right? And we give and go back, right, to some other historical elements where, you know, Black people were thought to not feel pain at all. Even like this kind of what I call like the phantom limb experience. 25 million Black people were lost, even more through, you know, the transatlantic slave trade and through the Jim Crow eras and think Reformation, things like that, right? And so I don't want to refer to them as like their phantom, like kin, right, in the body of the Black collective. And, you know, it's like to still feel that pain, to still, you know, to go to like the EGI and go to the Peace and Justice Memorial in Montgomery and look at the hanging boxes and know that they represent people who were actually hung, people who were actually lynched, to go to the Legacy Museum and to think about, right, and that pain. I'm like, that was some immense pain that I cannot explain to you, right? But I know that it has marked me, right? I know I'm marked by it.
We have to take a short break. More in just a minute. Support for the Stateside Podcast comes from Kalamazoo College, offering a personalized education that combines critical thinking, curiosity, and creativity. Committed to preparing students for meaningful careers that make a positive impact on the world. More at kzoo.edu.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside Podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
The third section of the book is a poem. It's a one-word poem. Mm-hmm. And before we talk about it, could you read the title? Because it's kind of unusually titled this well.
Yeah, all my titles are so strange. But yeah, so this piece is Black Existentialism number 8, Ad Infinitum or Ad Nauseam.
So this is a one-word poem, and the word is the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very creatively presented. Could you describe, for those who can't see the book right now, what they would see if they were looking at this?
Definitely. So this, and this iteration of it in particular, is, I think it's a like 18 panel spread. You open up the poem, and on the two pages that you open up to when the poem starts, it's just the N-word, N-I-G-G-A-S. As you turn it, what we start to see is the S's begin to multiply, almost like when cells split apart.
Yeah.
Right? And that's how we start to kind of see and then engage with the word in its totality. It's these split, fragmented images of the S. I was really toying with some gestalt principles of, you know, background, foreground, individual parts, the whole. So what happens is the S's actually start to create an image of a Cuban link chain.
The image of the words on the page is as much of the experience as the poetry itself. Mm-hmm. Did you do the design of this for the printing?
Yes.
How did this come to be a part of this writing for you?
That's a great question. It actually came from a prompt from my now very close friend who was once a former instructor of mine, Will Daddario, gave us this prompt in his poetry, philosophy, and performance class to write a one-word poem. And so I was kind of thinking conceptually. I'm like, you know, a one-word poem has to be conceptually tight. It has to conceptually make sense, right? The title and the word, they're going to be doing most of the work. But I also want to take it a step further. I'm like, what about a one-word poem that doesn't end, as the title of this piece might suggest, right? So the ad infinitum, thinking about, you know, the Latinate conversion of to suggest something that goes on and on and on forever, forever into eternity. Or the ad nauseum part, which is something that goes on and on and on forever until the point that it makes you sick. And so those two contexts, I was kind of imagining, you know, that the N-word occupies, right, both of those spaces. Something that will go on and on and on forever. No one will stop using this word, right? Mm. But the other coin, the other side of that coin, rather, is that there is a little bit of a sickness that might come up, right? That in, or like, yeah. you know, that ambivalence, right? You know, the history of that word can never be, you know, elided or replaced or erased, all right? And not even the process of amelioration that Black folks have done to change, right, the pragmatic use of that word, that still can't erase the history. So in some ways, that history that still persists along with the use of this word is really kind of the thing that's causing me nausea. And I think might actually cause a lot of us nausea if we, you know, really just sit and think about it, think with it.
The fourth part of the book, well, let me just say, you're originally from Flint. Mm-hmm. And the fourth part of the book is a series of writings and poems all about Flint. There's a poem called Breach that gives us a sense of the water crisis not as one thing. You know, if you just look at it from the outside and read the news accounts, you might think, oh, there was this one day the water got turned on and then one day people got poisoned. But Breach really gives us the sense of an ongoing, unfolding nightmare.
March 25, 2014, a water main has broken at an unspecified location. August 16, 2014, tests confirm the presence of fecal coliform bacteria in the tap water on Flint's west side. A boil water advisory has been put into effect.
When I was doing the research for Breach and looking up how many water main breaks were happening throughout the city during this time, even leading up before the water crisis and after, it was astounding to realize how bad the system itself was, how bad that infrastructure was, to have it be exacerbated and compounded with this policy decision that threatened the lives of like 100,000 people. It just kind of further drives home that the notion that, you know, we don't know what's going on. Even people who live here didn't know what was going on. Or we didn't have all the pieces staged in front of us so we could put the whole picture together.
One of the things I really appreciate about it, too, is that you do give us a full picture of what it is like to live in Flint, not just in the context of the water problems. Mm-hmm. But the noise pollution, mm-hmm. there's a really wonderful piece called Incubation that has reportage of everyday life and then interrupts itself with this sound of a burglar alarm that will not stop going off. Sounds like in the middle of the night, right?
Yes. So this was, I pretty much call it like a type of psychological warfare. Right across the street, actually from where I'm at right now, still, right across the street was this abandoned kind of projects. And every night for over a year between 10 p.m. and 8 a.m., when people are supposed to be sleeping, this loud, loud, I call it a sound installation. I don't even know if it's an alarm. It seemed like a sound installation because I'm like, what alarm you know doesn't ever go off?
This lasts for a year, despite complaint. Another day starts like this, stretched by the mile of voice sounding off from the intersection of Pearson and Clover Lawn, throwing itself to the undead which lay some distance elsewhere, the broke record of it, in the air, in the water, in the dream. Warning. Warning. You have violated an area protected by security. The authorities have been notified. Leave immediately. Warning. Warning. You have violated an area protected by security. The authorities have been notified. Leave immediately. Warning, warning. You have violated an area protected by security. The authorities have been notified. Leave immediately. Warning, 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 warning.
And no matter how much we complain about it, every night for over a year, this same sound.
The thing that just knocks me out about this poem is it brings home what it would be like, what it is like to hear that in your own home.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're in your home and you're being told you don't belong.
Exactly.
Here. You need to get out of here immediately.
Exactly. Exactly. And to some instances, you know, because that section deals with one of the kind of the undercurrents of that section is the survivor's guilt that I was, you know, struggling with because I did leave or I had already left. I think I started my PhD program in August of 2014 in Illinois. And so I left like 4 months after the water switch happened. when things started coming out in the news, it was like, oh God, like, how could I leave my family behind? How can I be away from my family when this stuff is happening? How can I be away from my city when this stuff is happening? Yeah. And people were telling me not to come back. Like, don't stay where you're at. We need you to stay in school. Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. But,
Jonah, I'm sorry. Rough. I didn't mean to take places you didn't want to go with this.
Oh, no. It's fine. No, this is great. It's fine. It's just real. It's just real, yeah. You know, just real life. But yeah, that was, and all I could do was write, pretty much.
Yeah.
All I could do was try to learn as much as about what was going on back home as I could and try to create this work that could accurately do justice to everything that was happening.
Jonah Mixon-Webster's poetry collection, Stereotype. Jonah, thank you so much for talking with us. We really appreciate you bringing us along for the trip.
Oh, thank you so much. This was a dream interview. Thank you.
And that's the Stateside podcast for today. You can find full Stateside episodes at michiganradio.org. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Today's episode was produced by Rachel Ishikawa with help from Laura. Our theme music is by 14KT, additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you so much for listening.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Williams.
I'm Lester Graham. We've been working on a big project about Great Lakes birds called the Bird Connection.
It will look at ducks and trumpeter swans,
egrets and herons,
and piping plovers. Yes!
We'll discuss what we've discovered at a Michigan Public Issues and Ale event,
including how some problems for birds are problems for people.
It's at Arbor Brewing Company in Ypsilanti, the evening of May 21st at 7.
You can register at michiganpublic.org.